Ashley's Memorial Day mattress sale is going on now. Save big on select adjustable mattress sets. Up to $1,200 on Beautyrest Black. Up to $800 on Purple. And up to $500 on Tempur-Pedic. Plus, get 72-month special financing with select in-store mattress purchases made with your Ashley Advantage Synchrony credit card between May 14th and June 3rd. Visit your local Ashley store or ashley.com for better sleep and savings. Only at Ashley. Subject to credit approval. Minimum monthly payments required. No minimum purchase required. See store for details.
Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben, welcome back from Budapest.
Here I am.
We missed you. We're doing our best to fuck up democracy while you were gone.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, we are recording that as the first exit polls start to dribble in the New Hampshire primary, which is bringing back some of the worst memories of our 2008
good and bad
political career. I believe we win Iowa. We all hang out for a day or two, and then they tell me, get your ass to headquarters because we need you to do like
I was already in
McCain
New Hampshire.
Rapid response. Yeah. You're in New Hampshire.
Yeah. I missed Iowa.
Unfold.
I was in New Hampshire for
lucky
the Iowa caucus.
You, yeah. You. How did that go? What wasn't your New Hampshire election night like?
So, well, first of all, I was staying in supporter housing, remember that?
Uh-huh.
With a woman who had me in a room full of, she collected like ships and bottles.
Okay.
So it was kind of interesting.
Very New England.
Very New England. But anyway, so, you know, like I was reminded of this because Favreau just tweeted about the Yes We Can speech. And, you know, first of all, what I remember is we thought we were going to win. I think our last, you know, friend of the pod, Joel Benenson, can correct us, but I think we were up 10 in our internals.
Yeah.
So the first thing is, John and I had to write the speech together because I was a guy in New Hampshire and John was obviously coming in. And we did not write a concession. So for Iowa, there had been a victory speech written and like a second place speech written. Then the other thing is we decided, well, what if we do this thing with a call and response and Yes We Can? And that was a kind of total accident of timing because two things had happened. Like Obama had dropped Yes We Can late in Iowa in one of his speeches. Mm-hmm. It had been his 2004 campaign slogan. And then in the debate, I'll never forget this, like Hillary started this attack line on Obama that he was raising hopes too high. And he kind of said something like, we need a president who will say, yes, we can, not no, we can't. And I remember hearing them being like, oh, that's a cool thing.
Cool.
And so John and I are going back and forth on AOL Instant Messenger. Remember how we all get.
That's how I communicated with everyone.
And so we're kind of like, well, what about this? We got to get a speech that could get to this kind of cool call and response about American history where we say, yes, we can. You know, we're going to the moon. Yes, we can. And let's face it. It was designed to be against Hillary's attack on us.
Right,
you know,
right.
That's how you come up with some of these ideas. And that night, though, we had to drive, I remember, a long distance. I don't even remember what, you know, Manchester to Concord or Nashua.
Yeah, sounds right.
And so we're driving a car with like a laptop open on John's lap, like speaking this speech aloud to each other. Then we're sitting in like the lobby of a hotel, like random people are coming up to us while we're writing this speech. But we're getting kind of giddy because we know it's good. We know that this call and response is going to be so good. Yes, we can. And I remember the pivotal line that took the longest. It took us, you know, to come up with that line in the long history of America. There's never been anything improbable about hope. I think, and John deserves the lion's share of the credit for that. That unlocked, you know, then this great mm-hmm. call and response. And then I remember Obama calls us, and we're like, we're super excited because we think we're about to win, and we think we just wrote this speech that's going to do really well. And he's like, well, I think we need a little more humility at the top, guys. It sounds like you guys are getting a little too, feeling yourselves a little too much. And so actually, we added what became the first couple of paragraphs that they kind of speak to like this isn't done and it's going to be hard, and we're really excited to watch the speech. And then New Hampshire primary day, I turn on TV and like, we're just losing.
We got our asses kicked.
Got our fucking asses kicked. We didn't just lose. And my first response was like, oh shit, we didn't write a speech for that. And so I remember we went into Obama's like suite and he's there and he looks kind of shell-shocked. And we're like, what do you want to do about the speech? And he kind of glances at it and he's like, well, just congratulate Hillary up top and the fucking speech. And the thing is, it works better.
It really did work better.
Because we lost. Like if we'd won, then that speech would have seemed like, you know, probably a little, you know, arrogant or maybe not arrogant's the right word, but a little triumphalist, right?
Sure, sure.
But in losing, it's as gritty, like, we won't give up. Yes, we can. And yes, we can. It always worked better when it's like, there are a lot of people out there telling you no, mm-hmm. you know? So I think the lesson for whoever loses tonight is your biggest losses can be your biggest victories in politics.
Give your victory speech. God, I remember Reed Cherlin, who had my job in New Hampshire, and then Ben LaBolt, who was another campaign spokesman, were like on the press riser waiting for the results to come in. And slowly they looked around and realized they were the only staffers left in the room with all these reporters, and like just slunk away.
They got descended. I think, you know, basically we were on like what is now our text chain was probably our email chain that night,
it was like
too,
BBM
like with
or
all of us, like, going back and forth and not believing the results. But again, then 2 days later, I remember waking up like with a 2-day hangover in my Chicago shitbox apartment to an email like of that video that they made of the Yes We Can speech. And then we raised, of course, like more money than anybody had ever raised. And our supporters got super motivated. And we came out and just kicked the shit out of everybody, through South Carolina and then through February. Remember all those primaries and caucuses. So I think the motivation that people took in that loss in a bizarre way helped propel Obama to the victory. And again, a lesson, I see a lot of people ready to declare this primary kind of over. I mean, there can be twists and turns in these things.
Things change. You know? I mean, look, the best thing that happened to us maybe was losing New Hampshire, because that meant the Reverend Wright stuff was vetted all out in the primary and it didn't get dropped on us in October before the election or whatever. But, you know, the good news is that it seems like so far New Hampshire is planning to count the ballots.
Yeah, that'd be a good start.
So that'll get us moving forward. But we digress. We have a lot of great foreign policy for you guys today. Here are some things we're going to talk about. There's a decades-long CIA effort to defeat encryption and global cryptography that we're going to dig into. A bunch of data security issues that I think should be more front of mind than they currently are. We're going to talk about QAnon, because that's a terrifying conspiracy that's bubbling up again. Sudan, North Korea, the Philippines. There's a Wall Street Journal editorial page effort to swiftboat Mayor Pete Buttigieg, which is outrageous bullshit, and we want to talk about that. We'll talk a bit about the Bernie Sanders foreign policy doctrine, the movie Parasite, just because it's great. And then we're going to be joined by Obama's former White House Ebola response coordinator, Ron Klain, to talk about the coronavirus, how bad it is or isn't, and what the administration is doing. So with that, let's do some news.
Let's do it.
Okay, so let's talk at the beginning about this Crypto AG. It's the name of this company. So the Washington Post on Tuesday published a piece with the headline, "The Intelligence Coup of the Century." It details the CIA and German intelligence effort to secretly purchase and own and operate the world's preeminent encryption company and use it to spy on allies, adversaries, everybody for decades. This reporting is all based on official histories of these programs, these secret programs that were produced by the CIA and by German intelligence that somehow leaked. The scope of this effort was enormous, but here's the gist. I mean, basically, the US and Germany started controlling this Swiss company, Crypto AG, in 1970. The company made encryption machines. Like, imagine a big typewriter and, you know, you type your message, it gets encoded, it goes to the other end, and they read it. It's supposed to be secret. And these countries all use it to send what they thought were secure communications. But the CIA and the NSA and the Germans ensured that flaws were basically hardwired into machines that made the codes easy for them to crack once they knew what to do. So the Germans stopped cooperating with us on this operation or stopped participating in it in the 1990s, but the U.S. continued it until 2018. The report says Crypto AG sold equipment to 120 countries, including Iran, India, Pakistan, but notably not the Soviet Union or China, who probably had a very appropriate wariness of Western encryption technology. Ben, it's a fascinating article. It's cool, sort of Cold War history. It's also notable that the recent fight with tech companies over end-to-end encrypted communications is hardly the first time the U.S. government has tried to weaken the world's encryption capabilities or beat them. It's also not the first or last time that the intelligence community have used some sort of private company as a front organization or a carve-out. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, fascinating to see a decades-long intel operation like this just fully laid out.
Yeah, I didn't expect to see that.
I mean, we knew nothing about this.
I mean, and this is actually one of the disappointing things about being in government. You get intelligence, but you don't really get the briefing on where it came from.
Yeah,
you know,
that's the secret stuff.
There's just another layer. I mean, a couple things jumped out at me. You know, the first is the extent to which I think we in the United States got comfortable over the course of kind of the Cold War in the last 70 years. That we were so far ahead of other countries that only we would have certain capabilities, right? Mm-hmm. And this felt like a story that is very much from a time when only the United States could do this. You know, the sophistication of the technology combined with the sophistication of the foreign intelligence relationship, in this case with West Germany, you know, combined with like other countries kind of trusting Western technology as being the best in the world.
Or having no choice, right?
And, or having no choice, right? And now, in 2020, we're in a world where Chinese technology is pretty well caught up to our technology. You know, the Russians have poured a lot of money into cyber. You know, I'm sure they had some good stuff in the Cold War too. But and more countries are, you know, Israel has a huge tech sector. And so, you know, we were joking, you know, even before we came in, like, oh, I wonder who owns, you know, Signal or, you know, WhatsApp is Facebook, but is there a back door there? I mean, I think part of the what's frightening about the world today from both kind of an American intelligence perspective, but just for any individual is how many countries might be exploiting similar vulnerabilities. It's a new world in that respect. And that puts more scrutiny on what the U.S. did because other countries want to copy what we did. The other thing I have to say is, like, when the Snowden disclosures happened, there was a bit of, like, you know, among our allies, like, we're shocked that the U.S. would be conducting surveillance. And at the time, even though I think it was right for some people to be, you know, asking very hard questions of the U.S. government about why we were doing certain things, and that was wholly appropriate, and we had to reform some of what we did, I do think some of these countries, Germany in particular, were kind of expressing outrage about things that they knew in their through their history that we were doing, and frankly, in some cases, they were doing with us. And here we have a great example. Even though they stopped in the 90s, clearly German intelligence knew they had a history of facilitating U.S. surveillance. So it does put a bit of a spotlight to me, you know, as someone who lived through it, on the fact that, you know, I think a lot of U.S. allies, you know, were either explicitly or at least implicitly aware that we were doing certain things. And a lot of that posturing around the Snowden disclosures was somewhat, you know, driven, you know, by being responsive to their politics and frankly, you know, glossing over what they themselves may have been party to.
Yeah, I mean, this article notes that at one point, maybe during the 80s, 90% of BND, the West German Intelligence Agency's intelligence products were derived from documents gotten through the Crypto AG machine. So this was a pretty productive relationship for them. That said, you know, it does seem to suggest that the Germans and the U.S. Had different levels of concern about who got caught up in this dragnet.
No, to be fair, Germans have always been more privacy concerned, in large part because of the history, not just of the Nazis, but of the Stasi in East Germany. And it makes sense to me that they would stop this in the 90s because the Cold War is over, you know, and maybe they want to kind of usher in a new world where there is more respect for privacy. So, no, I do want to give them that credit as well. I mean, look, I think part of this is how much technology is changing things too. I think, you know, just to look at Americans, like, I think there was a certain point, you know, in the Cold War when it was like, well, spies are people who go try to capture secrets about what bad guys are doing, you know, and obviously we know from subsequent history that they cast a much wider net at times and there were a lot of abuses in there. The thing about technology, though, is that this capacity now, you know, every single person in the world with any digital footprint, which is most people in the world, could feel vulnerable to this type of intelligence collection. And when you hear about encryption being busted, that's kind of your last frontier of privacy. And, you know, once again, it raises these issues we've been talking about how can governments simultaneously want to protect their national security and kind of uncover whether it's a terrorist plot or something dangerous, while being able to assure their citizens that there's some privacy out there.
Yeah, bulk collection becomes a real problem. Privacy and data security is going to be a bit of a theme of the top of this show. Yeah. So that brings me to the next issue I wanted to raise with you. So, Ben, the Likud party in Israel watched the Iowa Democratic Party's app disaster, and they said, hold my knish. Hannah, help me with that joke. So apparently there's an election app that's been used by the Israeli Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu's party, that may have exposed sensitive personal information for the country's entire national voter registration list. 6.5 million people. It's called the Elector app. It was designed to manage the party's voter outreach and tracking around their upcoming March 2nd election. So I guess some whistleblower, some tech person realized that there was this bug and that the app could expose the names and addresses and private data for basically every registered voter in the country. And that person blew the whistle on the flaws to the Israeli media, to Haaretz, I believe. The developer said the code was quickly fixed, but there are concerns that personal details for like military leaders, government officials, celebrities, whoever may have been exposed. Netanyahu has specifically asked his supporters to download the app, add additional people, et cetera. So, you know, again, like I am very much in favor of investing in and developing new campaign technology, especially because the Republicans have a huge advantage over us in terms of like voter data, et cetera. I'm very opposed to new election technology as the risk seems clearly way too high with these like Diebold machines we've talked about in the past. I mean, let's just use systems with a paper trail, literally. The Iowa Democratic Party app was sort of a hybrid of both because it's a party-run, you know, sort of election system. But it was obviously a disaster and unnecessary in so many ways. But I think more broadly, like this conversation we're having now, this story about this app should worry people because political parties at every level are going to have to really modernize and professionalize how they're storing and protecting data. Because I was talking to someone yesterday who, you know, we used to work with, who went and sort of did a tour of state parties and said, you know, if you look under the hood of some of these smaller organizations, it's not the most up-to-date software, you know, like things that are easily hackable. And I imagine even like local state boards of elections are pretty easy target. So it's frightening. And I guess the challenge is it's not totally clear to me who would be in charge of mandating standards to fix it.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's frightening is that at a time when more and more of these types of efforts are migrating to technological platforms like apps, lots of data is being collected, and potentially pieces of election infrastructure, you know, are even online, they are inherently vulnerable. And like, if anybody tells you they're not, they're lying to you. Like anything that is reliant and doesn't have a backup paper trail is vulnerable to cyber threats. And if you combine that with the fact that the most powerful people in this country, from the president on down, have now demonstrated that they cannot be held accountable for committing crimes, and that they frankly also cannot be held accountable for having other powerful countries commit crimes on their behalf, whether it be Russia, you know, poor Ukraine didn't actually do it. Right. But the point is that, like, let's say the Trump people, people associated with Trump, or let's say Saudi Arabia, or let's say China, like Saudi Arabia that we know hacked Jeff Bezos's phone, right? Like there are plenty of powerful actors with aggressive cyber tools that could seek to disrupt an election app, that could seek to disrupt. I mean, if you even take the Iowa case in miniature, you know, I saw the reports that in addition to the app failing, the Trump people were flooding the phone lines so that people couldn't phone in results too, right? Like that could happen digitally, right? Where China, Saudi Arabia, Russia, anybody who wants to see Trump to win,
like DDoS it.
Is doing some kind of attack on democratic or progressive infrastructure, or worst case, you know, election results, right? And so I think, you know, that is a fear of just the vulnerability of being reliant on technology. The other thing, again, I just feel kind of creeped out. If you looked at the Cambridge Analytica effort from Trump in 2016, this was an effort to gain far more data on people for political purposes than anybody knew they were giving, you know, so that essentially if you could burrow into people's Facebook likes and dislikes, you could construct very detailed personality profiles of people for the purposes of data targeting. Presumably, you know, Democrats will be doing some of this too. It makes me a little uncomfortable, but I guess that's where we are.
I just think it's a lot easier to use that information to suppress votes than to motivate them. Like the inherent advantage they have.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
It sucks. So in somewhat related news, federal prosecutors on Monday charged four Chinese intelligence officers with hacking Equifax. Remember this? The gigantic credit monitoring agency that has data on hundreds of millions of Americans, hundreds more billions of people globally. The hack itself became public in 2017. It was described by the FBI as the largest theft of private information by state-sponsored hackers ever. Equifax did a terrible job protecting all of our data. It's unconscionable when you really read through all the security steps they did not take. And better news, Congress has done nothing to tighten security requirements for the industry since then. So Ben, like, I guess it's not totally clear what the ultimate goal of this hack was by the Chinese. I think security experts probably think it's an invaluable way to find and root out US spies or figure out ways to hack people like us in the future or conduct industrial espionage. Like, pick your way. It's useful for them. But it's so frustrating because this is going to happen more and more. Like, you and I both had our information hacked by the Chinese as part of the Office of Personnel Management.
Yeah, OPM, I was going to raise that. Yeah.
It was like 21 million people.
Yeah.
And we've both probably been sucked up by countless other hacks at Equifax and other places like that. And no one gives you a clear answer of what you're supposed to do about it, right? You get a credit monitoring service, you can get LifeLock, you can change all your passwords, but no one's given you a new social security number, right? Yeah. I mean, like, what's the long-term fix for people who get fucked by these companies?
Yeah. Well, and also, like, if you think about it, there's like the OPM, Office of Personnel Management hack you mentioned, then this one, latest one. But that also makes you think, like, well, those are the hacks that we caught, you know, like, I what are we not seeing? Like, is it actually, they've hacked like kind of everything and these, we just happen to catch these two?
What's left over?
Yeah. Like, so I, you know, part of this, you know, we should not make the mistake of thinking that the only things that happen are the things that we become aware of. Right. And so that makes you think, okay, this could be much, much broader, more comprehensive, a danger than, you know, than we're even seeing in real time, you know. And in terms of what we have to do about it, again, I do think there has to be a clear explanation and regulatory framework that communicates to people, like, what is private and what is not, what will be done in the event of a hack like this, what are you told in terms of your own vulnerability? Mm-hmm. And then the last thing I think we have to be mindful of is that a lot of people and corporations too are, and governments for that matter, are making calculations based on the fact that they assume they might be hacked by the Chinese. I'll give you an example of this. I have talked to people in the private sector who have told me that they are not supposed to email internally critical opinions even about the Chinese government.
Seriously?
Yeah, because they do a lot of business in China and the Chinese might be monitoring their emails and they don't want the Chinese government to see a bunch of people talking shit about them, right?
It's a little bit of victim blaming there.
Well, and self-censorship is, you know, too. And you know, just in the same way that, you know, when you saw the hack of Sony after the interview came out, the movie that made fun of Kim Jong-un with like James Franco and, and Seth Rogen, you know, not only did that ramifications for Sony, but I haven't seen anybody else make any movies that are critical of North Korea since. No. You know, like, so the point is, I think there's a deterrent, and, you know, China wants to be in your head, you know, and like, just like North Korea wanted to get in your head with that hack. We have to, you know, I worry that this could be like shaping behaviors more than we're even aware of, you know.
I think that's totally right. I mean, look, like, online trolling shapes people's behavior. God forbid, like, they got all your personal information.
Yeah. If you know that someone might be reading your emails, might have your personal information, like, does that end up shaping corporate behavior? Does that end up shaping the behavior of organizations, of diplomats? You know, I mean, we're kind of in a new world here where this capability, for particularly for a government like China, can do a lot of work for them because it leads other people to kind of self-censor.
Yeah. Well, it gets a little weirder because, you know, sometimes we're able to sow disinformation to ourselves.
Yeah. Like, we're the best at it.
Well, yeah, we're the best at it.
So Democratic Party.
Here's a good example. Yeah. So this is an issue that I've been obsessed with for a very long time, and it's become a national security problem, which is this QAnon conspiracy.
Oh, yeah.
So it's literally impossible to summarize this thing fully because it's so complicated and crazy and diffuse. But here's the gist. In 2017, someone started posting on 4chan, which is a message board that's gotten in some trouble, under the name Q Clearance Patriot. So Q Clearance is the classification designation given out by the U.S. government, I think, to get you read into nuclear secrets. I didn't have a Q Clearance because I didn't go look at the bomb, but I don't know if you did. Mm-hmm. Regardless, through these anonymous posts, this person Q, in quotes, they've woven this conspiracy theory that Bob Mueller was really investigating Hillary Clinton and that Trump was recruited to run for office by the military to fight a deep state cabal. And there's a child sex trafficking ring run by Satan worshipers and pedophiles and cannibals. I'm not making up any of that. Some Q fans literally believe that John F. Kennedy Jr. is part of this and that he is still alive and will be revealed as the replacement for Mike Pence on the 2020 ticket as VP. So that's pretty cool if that's true. So next level crazy shit. But what started as this fringe internet-y thing has become more mainstream. So you see these people at Trump rallies all the time. Yeah. They're selling Q merchandise. They're briefing people on the theory. There was a Florida cop protecting Mike Pence on a recent visit who wore a Q patch, and it was in a photo. Candidates for office are promoting it, and Q adherents have been arrested in 7 different incidents, including an armed standoff with police at the Hoover Dam. So it's gotten very serious. There was like a killer, like a mob killer, wrote Q on his hand and held it up in court at trial. So Mike McIntyre and Kevin Roos at the New York Times, they did this great big piece on the phenomenon over the weekend, which sort of got into my head to want to talk about it today. But there's 2 parts to this, I think. Like, there's the obvious risk from these specific people and the fact that they think that there's like this death cult that they're solving, and they will literally stop at nothing to take out these evil Democrats who are doing it. So that's scary. But there's this other bigger risk of just people finding and believing these conspiracy theories online. And it doesn't matter if it's QAnon or Flat Earth or anti-vaccination literature. When there's just a certain volume of material on a subject, I think you start to believe it, right? Because how could 1,000 posts all be wrong? And it's dangerous. It can get weaponized by bad actors. The spread of it is enabled by Facebook, Google, YouTube, Twitter, who help people make money off of it and make money themselves. And so it's just worrisome to see something like that's as on its face insane as this get so much traction.
Yeah. It, you know, there's something that must be irresistible to the human brain about conspiracy theories. But you're right that the explosion of technology has made this much more serious. I mean, a brief story I'd give about this, Tommy, is that, you know, way back when, in 2002 to 2004, I helped out with the 9/11 Commission. I worked for the guy who was co-chair of the 9/11 Commission for the Democrats. And so, you know, I learned a lot about that event. So I had a blog back then, right? I blogged on some website.
Really?
Nobody read it. I don't even remember what it was called. But like once a week, you know, I would like blog something and nobody would ever respond. You know, there was very little comments. One time I decided to just make to blog about 9/11 conspiracy theories and, you know, how crazy they were and how they were debunked in the 9/11 Commission report. And I think I said something about like people, you know, in their parents' basement, like, you know, something kind of ad hominem. I got like thousands of emails because my email was linked to this blog. They were the most crazy, like way before social media, right? It was like getting a garbage Twitter thread in your email inbox. And it made me, I'm like, who are these people and how are they finding each other? And these are just websites, right? Now you have social media. So the capacity, you know, of this information to spread. So the, like if those were the 9/11 truthers in like 2004, like how many are there today now that you have these very sophisticated platforms that are designed to breed clicks and to build networks and to get people connected to one another. And I think we can chuckle at this stuff, but there's like millions and millions of people consuming this QAnon insanity. And you're right, like we're going to wake up one day. I hope this isn't the case, but what I fear is there will be a significant act of like political violence in this country carried out by somebody, you know? I mean, we all laugh at the Pizzagate thing, but if that guy had like opened fire, he could have killed a bunch of people, right? Because of, again, some QAnon type conspiracy theory. And so, you know, I think this is a national security threat, you know, that essentially this stuff disseminates, propagates with, you know, and it's treated like this kind of amusing novelty. And frankly, the Trump people surf it, you know, like they know that it creates a kind of energy that helps fuel their guy, you know?
Totally.
All manner of conspiracy theories do. But this stuff leads to dark places. And one place it could is to very real violence.
Yeah. I mean, I saw the FBI put out a bulletin about the risk of political violence, including QAnon. The Atlantic published a long piece by McKay Coppins about how Trump has basically built this billion-dollar disinformation campaign that is his reelection campaign. I mean, I saw Obama literally just tweeted out the article.
And by the way, how many in all this Trump stuff and all this Facebook stuff that they do, how many winks do you think there are at stuff like QAnon?
Oh, tons,
you
know? Because they want them motivated.
Totally. So they're giving the head nod. Like they know how to do the dog whistle on some of this stuff.
Yeah, I just think people need to realize that the 2020 election is not going to be fought through the press. It's going to be almost exclusively on Facebook and social media.
Yeah, like dark garbage. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not good. Pod Save the World is brought to you by the UN Refugee Agency. The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations, and they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation. That's unrefugees.org/donation. Let's do some good news.
Yeah.
I'm very happy to say that there is good news out of Sudan. So the Sudanese government has agreed to hand over former President Omar al-Bashir, who is a genocidal maniac responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people in Darfur, to the International Criminal Court, the ICC. That means he will likely appear at The Hague for a tribunal as part of a negotiated agreement between Sudan's government and these rebel groups. The ICC was basically created to deal with people like Bashir who were accused of genocide or war crimes or crimes against humanity. It hasn't been as effective, I think, as some people would like it to be in terms of getting convictions, but good step forward. Ben, any best wishes for Bashir or thoughts on what this might mean for Sudan?
Well, I hope it goes through. You know, like you can, I'm sure there's some people in Sudan who want to kind of throw some, you know, wrenches in the gears here. So until Bashir is literally handed over to somebody, you know, like it's still not definite. But look, I think it's, if this does go forward, it's huge in that it, one, indicates that the current Sudanese government is getting pretty real here. You know, like this is a big step for them to take. But and also like the accountability message is important in two directions. Obviously for people who were victims of the genocide in Darfur or had family caught up in that genocide, you know, it's a measure of justice. But the idea is that this is also supposed to be a deterrent, right? Or it's a message, say, to the Burmese military, mm-hmm. you know, like, look what can happen to you someday. Yeah. Like Bashir thought he was in the clear. Like he thought all those years he was going to escape justice. And I think part of what the ICC has to demonstrate is no, eventually, like, you know, you'll face the music here. And that going forward, the more that happens, the more there is accountability imposed on things that have happened in the past, the more credible it is as a deterrent against atrocities going forward, because people see, okay, I don't want to end up in the brig.
Yeah. Okay, so it's some unrelated news out of North Korea that should surprise no one. A confidential UN report seen by Reuters says that North Korea continued to enhance its nuclear and ballistic missile program in 2019, despite sending very nice notes to Donald Trump. So we learned that today. Yeah. They also imported petroleum and exported coal. And all of that activity was in violation of a bunch of UN Security Council resolutions. Specifically, they conducted 13 missile tests. They launched 25 missiles, including some new sub-launched version that seems destabilizing. And, you know, just generally gave the finger to the U.S. and our allies in South Korea and Japan. So to summarize, North Korea steaming ahead on its nuclear program. The sanctions are not working, but they are hurting average people living in North Korea. And I think Trump just wants to ignore it through the reelect, probably. Yeah. Interesting, like they had promised some sort of Christmas present or surprise at the end of last year that turned out to be a bluff, maybe, or maybe it got...
We never know.
You know, there was a deal cut, but, you know, nothing about this is settled.
Well, you know, chief antagonist of the pod, Mike Pompeo, let's just, you know, step back. Basically has been consumed by two issues, right? He's Mr. North Korea. Remember, he was like doing that account at the CIA and then came over state. Doing a bang-up job, Mike, with North Korea as they build new missiles and nuclear weapons and draw huge divisions between the U.S. and our allies, like failed across the scorecard here. And then his other big thing, of course, is Iran, and we know how that's gone. They've, you know, they're going the way of North Korea now. They're resuming their nuclear program. So, again, in the running for most odious Trump administration character and in the running for worst Secretary of State in the history of the United States, mm-hmm. like this is a good another data point for Mike Pompeo.
Yeah, I agree with that. And one other quick note on Iran. So we've talked a bunch of times about the decision to assassinate Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian general. In response, we all remember that Iran fired a bunch of ballistic missiles at Al-Assad Air Base in Iraq. Initially, remember, Trump said everything is fine, all is well. Then he dismissed early reports of people having traumatic brain injuries as just headaches. So weeks and weeks later, we now know that 109 U.S. troops have been diagnosed with traumatic brain injuries. 76 have returned to duty, so that's good news. But I still think, like to your point earlier, it is scandalous how much Pompeo and Trump and really the Pentagon as well have downplayed or misled the public about this.
Well, and Trump tweeted all is well that night, you know, at the same time that missiles are going off close enough to these service members that they're getting traumatic brain injury, which can have repercussions for the rest of their lives, right? At the same time, the next day, you know, Trump, people are out there spinning on what a great win this is. Like, is it a win for these guys, you know? And also, though, it makes you can you trust any fucking thing these people say? I mean, they literally lie about everything. Like, they clearly didn't want to reveal that there were any casualties. But meanwhile, these guys are being medevaced to Germany, medically evacuated to Germany. And then drip by drip, you know, week by week, the number keeps growing. And how can you trust anything? And if you can't trust basic information from the U.S. government, like how many Americans were harmed in a ballistic missile attack, you really can't trust anything that they say about anything. And shame on the Pentagon. Like, somebody went along with this because they suppressed this information over time. Like what is going on in the U.S. government? This is absolutely absurd.
Trumpified top to bottom.
Yeah.
We don't talk a lot about the Philippines on the show, but there's two big pieces of news that we should cover. So first, the Philippines, apparently, according to the AP, notified the U.S. that they plan to end in 180 days a security agreement that allows U.S. forces to train in the Philippines. It'll end this agreement unless we come to some follow-on agreement, I guess. So it's called the Visiting Forces Agreement, or VFA. It allows large numbers of American service members and U.S. military ships and aircrafts into the Philippines for joint training with the military there. We have other agreements that allow us to build and maintain bases and store equipment, et cetera. So it's a deep relationship that goes back decades. The president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, is just a monster. He is best known for extrajudicial killings, misogyny, homophobia, generally being an evil guy. It seems like he's pissed off because the U.S. canceled a visa for one of his political allies who is connected to his anti-drug crusade, where he just literally kills everybody. But, you know, Duterte has also just been generally moving away from the U.S. and toward the Chinese because presumably they care less about his human rights violations and don't push him on it. The AP quoted him as saying, "America is very rude. They are so rude," which is a funny quote. The U.S. has provided, I think, $550 million in military assistance to the Philippines in the last 3 or 4 years. We do all kinds of joint military operations and exercises. It's hard to tell, Ben, if this is a bluff. We have a big, complicated web of alliances with these guys. But how big a deal do you think it would be if that military-to-military relationship was severed?
Well, you know, first of all, it's funny for him to, you know, accuse the U.S. of being rude. We had to cancel our one scheduled meeting with Duterte when he called President Obama a son of a whore, I think, which was not polite. I don't know, you know, rude might be a good word for it. Look, it's a really big deal because essentially the way in which, like, the military of the Philippines is designed is, like, you know, the capacity to have, like, training exercises with us, to get equipment from us, like, that's, you know, what helps that military run. And, you know, I participated in negotiating some of these base access agreements. And if you essentially begin to, if you cut that tie, if you cut that connectivity, that capacity for the U.S. to kind of cycle through and have some personnel coming through, then the capacity for, you know, the Philippines military to operate at the level that it should, you know, begins to atrophy very quickly. More important, I think the political bond starts to break. And we have a mutual defense treaty with the Philippines. Like, we have an alliance with them that is like our alliance with our European allies. If they're attacked, we will defend them, and, you know, and vice versa. And here's what's at stake there. There are a number of islands. You know, the Chinese claim the entire South China Sea, the so-called Nine Dash Line. That's the border that China says is their maritime border in the South China Sea. And if you look out on a map, it's totally insane because it basically snakes around the coast of every country, the Vietnam, Philippines, like China's just claiming all this water, including some contested islands, some contested kind of fishing areas. And, you know, they've been really testing the limits with the Philippines and frankly with that U.S.-Philippines defense treaty on how far they can push. But if the U.S. is pulling back and the Philippines is moving away from the U.S., like it is a blinking green light for the Chinese to just try to dominate that entire maritime space, to move into the Philippines big time with corruption, bribes, and, you know, Duterte is probably an easy mark, and essentially to kind of begin to try to consolidate Chinese domination over this space, you know. And look, that's bad. That's worrying, you know, because trillions of dollars in goods flows through the South China Sea. So there are very real U.S. interests at stake there. I think it's also bad for, you know, things like democracy, because if a corrupt authoritarian like Duterte thinks it's probably easier, even if his nation loses something in the bargain, to just throw in his lot with the Chinese and put up with the Americans, well, then the future of Philippines is probably more likely to look like China than a democracy. And I think that's bad for the people in the Philippines too. So, you know, I'd watch this as a measure of whether this is a broader, you know, Filipino shift away from the U.S. alliance and towards China. That's certainly what it feels like right now, but Duterte swings in different directions.
Yeah. Sometimes. I mean, the other sort of related story that you flagged is that the government of the Philippines is trying to shut down one of the country's biggest broadcast networks.
Yeah.
So Duterte's solicitor general, he framed this move as an anti-corruption effort, but most people think he's just punishing media outlets that question his approach to fighting drug use, which again can be summarized as basically just literally killing anyone even suspected of being involved in drugs and or using drug raids as a front to kill people that they don't want around anymore. So previously, Duterte tried to shut down a different news site called Rappler that hasn't been successful so far. But, you know, like he is running the authoritarian playbook that you see in Russia, Hungary, maybe the U.S. if we're not lucky.
Yeah, no, that's right. And you know, I think you see, you know, this is the both the democratic backsliding and the emergence of China, like in one place, like, you know, you see these threads coming, you know, coming together. And, you know, this is happening in more and more places, and it's not always on the front burner, but it's a part of what I think is the macro trend in the world, which is rising Chinese influence, diminishing American influence, rising authoritarian trend lines, diminishing democratic trend lines. And, you know, that should worry people. That's what, you know, we need to reverse.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of really courageous people in the Philippines, including independent journalists who've, you know, some who've been detained in the Philippines who are standing up to this. You know, we should aim to have their backs as best we can. Because he's killing just drug users too. Like sometimes they just shoot people for using drugs. I mean, this is really the extrajudicial killing piece that has propelled him. Is really kind of odious.
Yeah, and we're talking like thousands of thousands of people reportedly. Two 2020 things before we get to our guest, Ron Klain, to talk about the coronavirus. So the Wall Street Journal editorial page this week decided that they wanted to jumpstart the process of swift voting Mayor Pete this cycle. And for our listeners who may not have been paying close attention to the 2004 election, swift voting is a reference to the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, which was this just odious right-wing front group that tried, unfortunately with a lot of success, to undercut, denigrate John Kerry's military service in Vietnam. So the author of this piece and the journal's op-ed page is a Marine Corps veteran and a current host at the right-wing outlet Newsmax. He criticized Mayor Pete for basically getting what's called a direct commission. That means he didn't attend a service academy or go through ROTC. He also just generally seemed to suggest that, you know, Pete's service wasn't gritty enough. Like he criticizes him for knowing how many times he went outside the wire, meaning was driving a convoy or providing security for one off a base in Afghanistan, as if that's a safe thing to be doing. So just a few thoughts on this. Like first, just factually, Pete signed up to serve in the military knowing that he did not have to and knowing that it put his life at risk. Second, like, again, driving around Afghanistan is not safe. There are Taliban attacks, kidnappings, horrific car bombs, and just living in a war zone is dangerous, right? I mean, these bases are frequently targeted by rockets and mortar fire. We just assassinated a military leader in Iran because we thought his proxy forces were firing rockets at a base in Iraq. So obviously things can get hairy real fast. Now, politically, I think that like Democrats need to be clear-eyed that Republicans care more about their political party than they respect military service. Yeah. I mean, a military record will not prevent or protect Democrats from these attacks. George McGovern was a war hero, a bomber pilot in World War II. John Kerry was a war hero. Yeah. Like, the list goes on and on. They were attacked and smeared without a second thought. That said, if you're a Democrat, I don't care who you support, we should all push back on this kind of bullshit because it is, it's a disgusting smear.
Yeah. And look, you're right. Like, the Kerry was a legitimate war hero, you know, in addition to serving. I mean, he was in some serious shit and, like, came to the aid of his fellow service members, and they look what they did to him, right? Yeah. So of course they're going to speak Buttigieg. And the bottom line here, yeah, did Pete, you know, rescue like 20 people from like enemy fire and dive on a, you know, like, no, but like the bottom line is, like, Pete Buttigieg signed up to serve. I didn't. Like, you didn't. Yeah. Like, I don't know. You know, probably most of the fucking Wall Street Journal editorial page didn't. Donald Trump sure as hell didn't.
Yeah.
And you're right. Like, you sign up, you're going to be in harm's way. Like, you're going to Afghanistan to serve in a war. Like, yeah, you're driving convoys. Like, that's how there have been a lot of casualties in these wars, is like roadside bombs or like insurgent attacks on convoys. So, like, this is such complete and utter bullshit. And I'm glad you made the point that, like, look, even if Pete Buttigieg is not your guy in the Democratic primary, like, we should all have his back on this, because this is fucking bullshit. And this is how, like, you know, they seek to undermine support for whoever the Democratic nominee would be, take the thing about them that is admired and just go right at it, you know? So I do think this is one where, you know, everybody should call out the BS on this and have Pete's back.
Yeah. Let's talk about Bernie for a minute, because The Atlantic tried to take on, describe, define what the Bernie Sanders foreign policy doctrine would be. So, you know, Ben, you and I have been through a few rounds of these, like, doctrine stories, and they're always a bit frustrating.
Yeah, because
it's hard to summarize, like, how you'd approach the world in a simple doctrine. But it's an interesting piece, and it suggests some ways that I think Bernie would be different from past presidents or Obama on foreign policy. So some of the specifics are, it's, you know, like, he's professed an even greater hesitation to use military force. So probably a more likely a 2016 version of Obama, where he ended up, versus 2009,
yeah,
when he was surging troops.
Good way to say it.
And a greater emphasis on diplomatic and economic tools. Some of the top priorities he would put forward are climate change, kleptocracy, global economic inequality, and dealing with authoritarians and far right political movements. So all things we should deal with. You probably see serious efforts to cut Pentagon spending. Bernie's top foreign policy aide, Matt Dust, said Bernie would get U.S. troops out of Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria by the end of his first term. And he said they'd also consider shrinking the U.S. military footprint in Japan, Korea, and Germany, which I thought was interesting. And then Congressman Ro Khanna, who I believe is like a co-chair or something of the campaign, suggested that Bernie might be open to withdrawing troops from South Korea as part of a broader process to denuclearize the peninsula, meaning, like, that's what the North Koreans want, to get rid of their nukes, right? They want us the fuck out of there. So that might be part of an eventual deal. And then the bar for using military action was described as an imminent threat to Americans or preventing mass atrocities. So, interesting piece. Curious what you thought. And then I'm just curious, like, also kind of curious what you think the big differences are between kind of the top candidates on foreign policy, if anyone besides Bernie feels particularly distinguished or different to you.
Well, I think, you know, I do think what I like about Bernie's approach is not just, you know, ending the wars and trying to kind of definitively put a period on the kind of post 9/11 Iraq, Afghanistan military interventions. But more than that, I really like that priority set, you know, climate change, kleptocracy, which is tied, you know, very directly to authoritarianism, which we talk about here. You know, there's, I think, a reprioritization of American foreign policy that is really important. That, like, you know, when you and I went into politics, like, American foreign policy was about terrorism, Iraq, you know. Well, that was it.
Yeah,
it was kind of the dominant, you know.
Short list.
And now, like, what do we end up talking about on this podcast? Like, so technology, social media, vulnerabilities, disinformation, authoritarianism, climate change, which is going to have all of these other effects. And so what I do think is really constructive is Bernie refocusing on the actual priorities that I think implicate American national security and like life on this planet for the foreseeable future. And by the way, that is a big shift, because if that is actually implemented, it's not just about getting troops out of Iraq and Afghanistan the first term. It's about how do you spend money? Like, what is a budgetary priority here? And saying, yeah, this means we're going to have to spend less on defense so we can spend more on some of these other things is, I think, both necessary and a brave thing for them to say. It means changing how you develop your national security workforce. You know, all the incentives for careers were to be like a terrorism person or a Middle East person. Like, you got to get people trained up and focused on these issues. So to me, like, Bernie reflects like this shift towards not just away from the wars, but to what the next chapter is going to be about. You know, the Germany, Japan, South Korea stuff, like, I've saturated in the juices of the blob at times, but I always get a little wary. I see what Roe is saying. Like, I want to make sure that we're not giving that away on the front end. You know, that what China and North Korea wants is the U.S. out of that peninsula. Like, what are we getting for that? You know, that unlike Iraq or Afghanistan, for instance, the goal should not be the removal of U.S. troops. The goal should be a change in the dynamic in the peninsula, a change in North Korea's nuclear program. And then let's see, like, how U.S. troops come into the picture. But I think it's worth revisiting. Look, I'd like to close the, you know, not just the prison in Guantanamo Bay, I'd like to close the naval base in Guantanamo Bay. I think that's something that maybe Bernie could get into.
There you go.
I think in terms of the differences, I do think there are real differences. I mean, I think that, you know, Biden would reflect kind of wanting to go back to a familiar approach to U.S. foreign policy that has a lot of very good things about it, that is invested in our alliances and invested in trying to support democracy and human rights around the world, that is invested in multilateral approaches, but that is probably more in line with the traditional issue set, you know, Russia, China, terrorism, Middle East, you know, whereas Bernie's talking about a different issue set, you know, with climate and authoritarianism, kleptocracy. And then I think Warren is very much kind of like in between, maybe a little bit closer to Bernie end of the spectrum, where she's reorienting American foreign policy, maybe not pledging to move quite as fast as Bernie. And, you know, Amy, you know, it's funny how the spectrum is the same as on domestic issues in some ways, where you got, you know, Bernie out here kind of really setting a new paradigm that I think is the right paradigm. The speed at which you move to that and how disruptive that is, I think is a legitimate question. Then Biden is the more kind of consensus status quo candidate. And then you got Warren a little bit closer to Bernie, Amy a little bit closer to Biden, and Pete kind of like right in the middle. Like, when I look at the foreign policies of the candidates, that's, they all want to move in the same direction. They all want to wind down the wars. They all want to focus on climate change. They all want to be more multilateral. You know, they all want to promote democracy and human rights. I think it's a bit of a question at how fast you move in that direction, how much are you willing to try to do things like cut the defense budget that will be contentious. And as usual, you know, breaks down where Bernie's probably for the most dramatic, rapid change, and the other candidates are at different levels of speed and incrementalism on that. The one last thing I would say is that Warren has put some really good meat on the bones on this question of standing up to authoritarianism and corruption around the world in ways that kind of also dovetail with her domestic message. I think that there are going to be a lot of good plans to look at the end of this primary, where I hope the nominee can take good things from each candidate. Like, Pete had some good ideas for how to end the war and change the authorization around the use of military force. You know, I think Amy, you know, was really important to getting the Iran deal done. And frankly, Amy was a huge supporter of the opening to Cuba too. So I think there's elements of all these foreign policies that, if actually melded together, would make for a strong Democratic Party platform.
Yeah, I mean, they've all staked out some interesting ground, right? Like, Warren put forward a no first use nuclear weapons policy, which we never got to during the Obama administration and probably should, which basically just says we won't nuke a country first.
Yeah.
Because a bunch of scary people in uniforms convince you that if there's a biological attack, you need to be able to nuke a country in response.
Yeah.
As if you couldn't just fucking do that anyway.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Well,
I mean, whatever. But the other, you know, in other areas, we haven't heard, I don't think most of the candidates talk much about are like drones.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I imagine that's an issue that animates a lot of Bernie supporters, yeah, a lot of progressives. Generally, I don't think I've, you know, you, it's hard to talk about the details of a lot of, you know, how you use certain tools in the world. But, you know, it'll be very interesting to see if these folks win, how far they actually go.
Yeah.
When you sit down in that meeting and you're told, like, there's a scary, you know, Al-Qaeda cell growing in fill in the blank country and, you know, our options are X, Y, and Z.
Well, and one way to think about this is that, you know, you have to envision, you know, as someone who's on a campaign, you come into government and you have to try to envision how they'd act. So let's say you care about drones, right? Right now, the U.S. is, I would assume, engaged in, you know, pretty aggressive use of drone strikes in lots of different countries, right?
Our airstrikes, I think, have ticked up so much across the board exponentially.
So that massive infrastructure will be in place on January 20th and on January 21st. And if Bernie Sanders is president of the United States, what is he going to do? Is he just going to shut that infrastructure down? And when everybody comes to him and says, well, you're going to put U.S. lives at risk and then go to Congress and leak that the lives are at risk, you know, how will Bernie respond? And, you know, frankly, I do think Bernie would be more likely to say, I'm going to shut this shit down.
Yeah, I think, you know, Bernie most likely to say, fuck you.
Whereas with Biden, you'd envision like, well, he'd probably want to have the aspiration of unwinding it, but like there'd be a pathway. So I think that it's interesting. And by the way, I'm not saying one is right or one is wrong, you know, but I do think the basic difference is that Bernie would be most likely to kind of upend certain activities of the U.S. national security state. Joe Biden would want to take an incremental approach towards pointing them in a different direction, you know, and I think the other candidates fall in that spectrum. And they also bring different backgrounds. Like Bernie's been kind of an activist, a cage rattler on the outside of these debates. You know, Warren's been on the Senate Armed Services Committee. I think she's developed a pretty good depth of understanding of a bunch of these issues too. From that perspective, you know, Amy's taken a particular interest in some of these issues in Congress. And like I said, might surprise you, like literally no bigger supporter for lifting the embargo against Cuba than Amy Klobuchar, right? Which doesn't fit on the left-right spectrum, but she's from an ag state, Minnesota, and she, you know, wants to to have agricultural cooperation with Cuba, and she's traveled and done the homework to know that it would help the Cuban people to do that, right? So again, I think there are things to take away from each of their experiences and their plans that that could lead to a very interesting platform for the party.
Yeah. Last thing I had before we get to our interview with Ron Klain about the coronavirus is you just want to talk about Parasite because you love the movie.
I love Parasite.
It's an awesome movie.
Yeah. Like I have to say, like, well, first of all, you know, my wife was a little more mixed on it because once it got to like, and I don't know if there's spoilers here, I won't say in a way that's a total spoiler, but like once basements came into the picture, you know, like she was a little weirded out by it. I have to say when I saw it though, I just remember thinking to myself, like about, you know, 40 minutes in, like, how has nobody made a movie about inequality like this before? Mm-hmm. You know, like the dominant story arguably in the whole world for the last 30 years has been growing and gross economic inequality. And this movie in a pretty ingenious way both highlights that, satirizes it or however you want to, you know, overly dramatizes obviously the consequences of it. But I mean, it takes an amazing snapshot of like what is happening. And also just like a very cool shot at like Korean filmmaking.
Yeah. I mean, it was a beautiful film, incredibly well done. I also think it's jarring maybe for an American audience because of the fatalism around class in South Korea. Like if you are born poor, that is your destiny, right? Unless you literally like leech off this family, sort of the message. In America, that may also be true. Having rich parents is the biggest driver of you being successful and wealthy. But we tell ourselves this story about up from our bootstraps, et cetera, that I think like leads to much more hopeful, optimistic art and filmmaking, whereas this was like pretty brutal.
Well, one of the reasons I liked it is because it was like on this trend, on this issue. And look, there's some great American movies that are made, including some movies I'm about to mention, but like I do think that the politics has been like kind of oddly absent from a lot of big American movies lately and may have something to do with, you know, the global audience they're trying to reach. But if you look at the other movies that are up, like 1917, okay, let's go back and tell a story about World War One, like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I love, but like let's go back and revisit the Manson family. Meanwhile, it's the Korean movie that is like talking about, the issue that is shaping our politics, inequality, in my mind. And I don't know if that's because studios are afraid to touch certain things. Studios want to get into the Chinese market, or what is it? But like, it was interesting to me that of these contenders, you know, Little Women, great movie, but you know, and yeah, sure, are there some echoes in terms of like today? Sure, but like, this is a movie that is like spot on. Like, hey, I'm gonna like take one of the most uncomfortable issues in the world today and just put my thumb right on it and push. You know, it'd be cool to have more. I mean, haven't you been waiting, Tommy, for like the, like I grew up watching those 70s movies where it was like coming out of Vietnam and Nixon, and you're watching like Apocalypse Now and All the President's Men and these fucking paranoid movies about the government. And when Trump got elected, I'm like, okay, we're going to have like a revival of like.
That's a good point.
You know, like, where are the fucking movies about like the world we're living in?
Yeah, that's a good question. I just finished like a 900-page book about Nixon that was the most fascinating thing I've ever read, called Nixon Land.
Oh yeah, yeah,
it's so,
yeah,
so yeah. Good. I immediately bought the next version of it. It's gets you to Reagan basically. But yeah, I mean, you're right that, well, I guess I think we'll probably learn that the current government is doing unbelievable things behind the scenes that we don't yet know about.
Yeah, and it might be a lag. It might take a few years.
Yeah, because the juxtaposition of what Nixon was saying and doing in public versus what was on those tapes where he was, you know, swearing to Haldeman and, you know, Colson and all this, like the plumbers unit that was breaking into the DNC and all this shit is unbelievable. And the fact that he was using CIA operatives and, you know, shutting down FBI investigations, like, it's staggering when you put it all together.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe the good art comes in like 5 years.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, the art. And when Trump is safely out of office, so this the major conglomerates that own these studios no longer have to worry about, about him.
Don Jr.'s first term. When we come back, we will have Ron Klain.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
We are thrilled to be joined by Ron Klain, who is Obama's White House Ebola response coordinator. Do we call you a czar? Are we allowed to use that word anymore?
You know, it's a little passe, but if you want to use it, you guys go right ahead.
Okay, great. From 2014 to 2015, where just the height of the outbreak, the media panic, and everything else, he's also a current advisor to Vice President Biden's campaign. Ron, thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me.
So we want to talk about the coronavirus today because as of early afternoon on Tuesday, the latest death toll is over 1,000 people. There are over 43,000 infections that we know about globally. In your opinion, I mean, how serious is this outbreak as compared to previous outbreaks like SARS, H1N1, Ebola? Like, where would you rank the your level of concern?
Well, so I think it's important, Tommy, to start off with this point, which is people remember when I took over the Ebola response in the fall of 2014, there was a lot of confusion about Ebola and what it meant and how dangerous it was, so on and so forth. But the fact is we knew a lot more about Ebola in the fall of 2014 than we know about this new virus right now. The world's leading medical experts didn't know it existed 6 weeks ago. And so there's just a lot of uncertainty about the basics. Uncertainty about how infectious it truly is, how much it's going to spread, how much it's spread already in China, how much we should expect it to spread outside of China. Doubts about how lethal it is, what will the fatality rate, the rate of serious illnesses wind up being. So what I'd say is I think we have reason to be concerned. I think there's reason for the U.S. to be more aggressive in the response than what's been mounted so far in many respects. Reason to be prepared for something, but I think no reason yet to be fearful, no reason to really panic or anything like that. I just think there are just a lot of unknowns about this virus and what its path is going to be.
So, Ron, you got very familiar, obviously, when you were running that response with what the tools are available to the U.S. government. And you know, you had to make use of, you know, a lot of existing tools and investments that have been made over many years in, you know, organizations like CDC. But also coming out of Ebola, we made some structural changes in how the U.S. government was organized to be able to deal with disease like this. You know, having a strong coordinator in the White House, you know, having a kind of working group in the different agencies of the U.S. government that are prepared to respond, and also building linkages with other countries globally. How concerned are you that we're going into this potential crisis, having under Trump dismantled some of that structure, or having tried to slash the budget for some of that preparedness that you know you have to count on?
Yeah, so I think it's a big concern at the leadership level. So, and that starts, as you said, Ben, with the fact that after I left as White House Ebola Response Coordinator, President Obama accepted my recommendation to create inside the National Security Council a directorate that would focus on these global health security issues, that would have a high-level person that would be helping us get ready for potential epidemics like this, helping us get prepared, helping us respond. And President Trump actually kept that structure for the first year and a half of his presidency. But when John Bolton took over in July of 2018, he basically disbanded the unit. It didn't really fit with his hard power vision of national security. And so we don't really have that coordinating function inside the White House. Now, why is that important? It's important because this is going to be a big interagency challenge. President Obama said that with regard to Ebola, he was mustering a whole of government response. To fight something like this, you need to not just have the agencies inside HHS, but you need the Defense Department working on it. You need the State Department working on it. You need Homeland Security working on it. And you can only really manage something like that from inside the White House. And secondly, it's an international issue, and foreign governments need to know who they're supposed to contact, who they're supposed to listen to on behalf of the United States. And again, I have a lot of respect for Alex Azar. I think he's doing a good job running the HHS part of this, but it's impossible for our Secretary of Health and Human Services to really represent the entire U.S. government. And so I think there's a big hole there. And then, of course, there's a second leadership hole inside the White House, and that's the one in the Oval Office. As you guys know, right, President Obama made a very hard decision, a controversial decision in the fall of 2014 to say, I'm going to let science and medicine dictate the direction of this response, dictate our policies, not politics, not fear. And it was an unpopular decision in many ways. I think it's one of the braver decisions President Obama made. And he stuck with that through thick and thin, and he saved a lot of lives. People need to remember that back in 2014, the leading forecast was that 1 million people would die in West Africa from Ebola. The death toll, tragic as it was 11,000. And hundreds of thousands of lives were saved thanks to President Obama's leadership in conjunction with other countries, in conjunction with the people of Africa itself, of course. They took the leading role. And now we have President Trump. President Trump attacked the Ebola response back 5 years ago. He called Obama a dope. He called Obama incompetent. He said we should leave Americans who are fighting the disease in West Africa to die there if they got the disease. And that's the person who's in charge, right? And so I think, you know, I think leadership problem is at both levels. You need a commander-in-chief who really can lean forward, who can be trusted, whose word is good, who's willing to make the hard decisions and put science over politics. And then you need a structure inside the White House to implement those policies. And we really have neither of those two things right now.
Ron, how concerned are you that the Chinese government is being straight with the World Health Organization or the international community about the scope of this outbreak?
So, Tommy, I think there's no question the Chinese government has not been completely straight and has either been slow or just unwilling to disclose things. They finally allowed a team from WHO in on the ground in the past 24 hours. They still have not allowed a team from the U.S. government, from the Centers for Disease Control, to be on the ground. We actually have CDC people who work in China. They are in China. They are not allowed to go to any of the relevant places because the Chinese government is banning them. I think some of that is the inevitable confusion and disorganization that you have with a crisis like this inside China, but some of it is unquestionably the Chinese government's tendency towards non-transparency, towards keeping things secrets and things like that. And so I think this is a big gap in our visibility. I think having the WHO on the ground will help, but the WHO is subject to pressures from countries like China. And so I think until we have American scientists, American doctors, American experts on the ground in China, we're going to be a little bit blind as to what's going on.
Well, and the other side of that, of course, is the U.S. government, Ron. And, you know, I remember at the height of the panic, like the only thing you had to hold on to was, you know, that you would hope that the the American people would trust the information that was given to them by their own government. You know, that essentially the U.S. government had to communicate to people, you know, here's what you have to worry about and here's what you don't have to worry about. There's a lot of misinformation out there. We talked about that, whether or not people should, you know, trust the Chinese government. But how do you think about responding to this type of disease in a situation where, one, the U.S. government barely communicates. There's not like a daily White House press briefing where we do a lot of this. Two, the U.S. government habitually lies about everything. And so you're not sure that you can trust that information. I mean, how do you imagine responding to something, having lost that trust that people used to, you know, defer to generally when it came to government statements? And also, if people out there are wondering about this, like, where should they be going? You know, should they be looking at the World Health Organization? Where should they look to for trusted information?
So look, I think, we have to be honest. There are some things we said, particularly in the early parts of the Ebola response, that turned out to be wrong. But we never lied to people. We sometimes were mistaken, but we never lied. Trump has already lied about this on three separate occasions. First, he said it's all under control. No one has anything to worry about. It isn't under control. Second, he said that we had sealed our borders airtight. We haven't sealed our borders airtight. And third, he repeated this thing today, the other day, where he said that it's going to be April and it's going to get warm and the virus is going to go away.
Right.
There's no scientific basis for that. So we have a problem. The president is trying to, as he always does, on things he's doing, you know, talk them up and boast about their success, whether that's true or not. And so that's a big problem, because we know from the track record of Donald Trump, we can't trust anything he says. We know on this specific issue, we can't trust anything he says. Now, what I'll say is we're very fortunate to have career people, and still in key places, people you and I worked with, people like Dr. Tony Fauci at NIH and Dr. Ann Shuchat and her team at CDC. And these are people who've served Democrats and Republicans alike. They're still in key roles. And I think I would look very closely to what they say and what they're telling us in their official communications, because I have a lot of confidence in them, a lot of confidence in them to be straight and honest with us. Now, look, the challenge is not whether or not we should listen to those people, but whether or not President Trump will listen to those people.
Yeah.
We know that the president doesn't like experts, he doesn't like medicine, he doesn't like science, and he doesn't like listening to people who tell him things he doesn't want to hear. And so I think when you look at these long-serving, you know, heroic Americans who've given their whole careers to the government to keep us safe, I trust them, I trust what they say, but I sure hope President Trump's listening to what they have to say.
So there's like a long-term approach to all these challenges, right, which is investment in global public health. What do you think Congress or the administration should be doing, and how does that compare to what they are doing?
So there's short-term and long-term answers on that. And as you said, Tommy, part of this is the long-term thing. We need to have a consistent strategy on pandemic preparedness. And I'll give you one really good example, which is one thing we built in 2014 as a part of the Ebola response that did not exist before then was a three-tiered system of medical facilities in the U.S. to intake, triage, identify, isolate, and ultimately treat people with dangerous infectious diseases. We had nothing like that before Ebola. We built it from scratch during the Ebola response. We have 10 super high-end hospitals, 60 hospitals, one in every major city that can treat patients. And the funding for that program is set to run out in May of this year. Now, will Congress renew it because of the coronavirus threat? Hopefully so. But absent that, we probably would have let that program lapse, and we would be back at square one like we were in Ebola. So I think, you know, for the long run, the point is consistent investments in our health security here at home and around the world, and a globalist perspective. I mean, look, fighting these viruses is in some ways no different than fighting terrorists in this sense, which is we kind of understand the fact that we have to fight the bad guys overseas if we don't want to see them here in our own country. And the same thing is true for these viruses. We have to help other countries in the same kind of thing, coalitions and alliances, fighting these diseases overseas to keep them from coming here. President Obama, for example, really helped get the African CDC off the ground so that the continent of Africa would have the kind of resources to identify and respond to novel new infections and diseases, so we wouldn't have to send 400 CDC people to Africa like we did in 2014. So those kinds of consistent investments in global preparedness is important. It's an argument against isolationism, against the American first mindset. In the short term, what the administration should be doing right now is what President Obama did do in 2014 and again in 2016 for Zika, which is put together an emergency spending package that goes to the Hill, that funds these investments at home, that funds what we need to do overseas, that funds the state and local functions of dealing with all the people who might have the disease, tracking them, monitoring them, you know, that helps fund some international relief. I think we will need to give help to poor countries where this virus spreads. And that package needs to get to Capitol Hill, and of course, Congress then needs to pass it.
Ron, and what are you most concerned about here? I mean, I guess if the best case scenario is that the virus proves to be not that lethal and that world health resources can be mobilized to kind of make it another treatable disease that is brought under control, in what you're observing here, is it the risk that it's much more widespread in China than we even know now, that it is potentially lethal, that it'll have secondary effects on the global economy, you know, given the centrality of China, the global economy? Like, what are the scenarios that you think might be underappreciated in the way this is being approached right now?
Well, I think there are a couple things that on the unknown list are worrisome. Might it be spreading more rapidly in China than we appreciate? Again, we don't really have great visibility into that. Might it spread more widely throughout Asia? It might. We don't really have great knowledge on that yet. Might there be more people walking around with this virus in other countries? Perhaps so. Trump has painted this picture that somehow he's already cut off travel from China. That's not true. That's not possible in the modern interconnected world. Thousands of people are still coming here every day from China. And so, I think that we need to be realistic about the fact that this virus is going to spread. And really, it's a question of how much we can kind of contain it, how much we can make its impact on the healthcare system level, how much we can be hopeful that it's not as severe. I think the things people should be looking for is, first of all, what is the impact on healthcare systems? How many healthcare workers in China are infected? How many healthcare workers in China wind up dying? That's where these things really kind of get out of control when they get into the healthcare system, when they get into hospitals, because it hits the healthcare workers. This virus, we know, is more impactful on people who are already sick and compromised. They're all put together one place in a hospital. It's a target-rich environment for viruses. So we want to watch that in their healthcare system and other healthcare systems. And I think the global wild card here is Africa. Africa is the continent, even notwithstanding my earlier comments, that is least prepared to deal with something like this, more prepared than it was 5 years ago, but still least prepared. So we know there's a lot of commerce and aid and movement of people between China and Africa, a big Chinese presence in Africa, and the possibility that some of that commerce, trade, exchange of people is going to bring this virus to the continent of Africa, is just a big big unknown factor.
Ron Klain, thank you so much for helping us understand this thing. We appreciate it, and we will continue to monitor it because I remain pretty terrified.
Yeah.
Thanks again, Ron.
Well, thanks for having me, guys.
Have a good one. Pod Save the World is a product of Crooked Media. The senior producer is Michael Martinez. Our assistant producer is Jordan Waller. It's mixed and edited by Chris Basil. Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Nar Malkonian, and Milo Kim, who film and share these interviews on video each week.
As a chef and a restaurant owner, I'm as meticulous about my cookware as I am about my ingredients. That's why I love Made In Cookware. Each pan they make isn't just designed to perform, it's crafted to last. As a mom, I love that I can trust Made In. It's made from the world's finest materials, so I can feel good about what I'm feeding my family. I'm Chef Brooke Williamson, and I use Made In Cookware.